The Big Story is brought to you by Scotiabank. Canada is a first-world, developed country. We are rich. Geopolitically speaking, we have universal health care, lots of natural resources, and a pretty solid safety net. So should we be worried about our life expectancy? It's still rising, for now. A little bit, anyway, at least in most areas of the country, but it's definitely not climbing the way it has been, and data from other countries prove that there's still room for it to grow, so why isn't it? Research from south of the border, where life expectancy is actually falling for the first time since the last World War, helps paint a picture, and it's not a pretty one. So what is causing American life expectancy to drop? How different are the circumstances we face in Canada? Are there some simple solutions that governments can adopt to help put us back on the right track? Or does this problem require a rethinking of how we run our country? If you want a hint on the last one, this episode features a senior scientist at a mental health institute discussing an overhaul of federal economic policy. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Dr. Jürgen Rem is the aforementioned senior scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto. He also works at the University of Toronto and writes for several journals. We're talking to him today because of a paper published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal that suggests that, yes, Canada is victim to the same factors causing life expectancy in the States to drop. Why is life expectancy such an important number to look at in a country?
It summarizes the overall trends in mortality, and it is one of the best measures to see how a country and a country's health is developing on balance. It is also related to non-fatal events. So if we look into other measures which are way more complicated, like DALYs or QALYs, they are usually not readily available on a yearly basis for scrutiny. Life expectancy still is the number one indicator which summarizes the health of a nation, even though it does not explicitly include fatalities, non-fatal events.
So what is life expectancy currently in Canada, and what are the trend lines around it?
Life expectancy in Canada is currently around 82 years. That is different by sex. If we look into the higher life expectancy, which in all countries of this world has been with women, women currently have a life expectancy close to 84 years, and they had been increasing from 8.5 years to 84 years in the last 25 years since 1990. For men, they have been increasing at a steeper rate from 74 to about 80 as a life expectancy also in those 25 years. The increases had been such that in the first 20 years, from 1990 to 2010, the increases were much steeper, both for women and for men, than in the last 5-6 years, meaning that we are closing and we are narrowing to a threshold in life expectancy. However, they can and should be increasing in the near future. Why? Because we know that those countries who provide the best environment in the overall policies have had much higher life expectancy than we experience in Canada today.
So tell me quickly, what is happening in America? What are the roots of a country like that seeing life expectancy fall?
We see two Americas. One is the poor America, more rural, more dominated by smaller towns, higher unemployment, overall a net decrease of income, and one, the urban tops, educated people with an increase in life expectancy, even over the last 5 years when the overall country was declining, increases in income, quite substantial increases in income, and a very positive outlook into the future. And those two Americas have been developing in different directions, not only with income, not only with hope or despair, but also with life expectancy and with different causes of death.
So explain to me what kind of contribution a lack of hope or income inequality actually makes to life expectancy. How does that impact it?
There are three so-called deaths of despair, and this term has been coined by Angus Deaton, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics some years ago. And it means that those deaths are all directly or indirectly related to sentiments of despair. The first is suicide. I think we don't have to explain a lot here. The two major diseases which are linked to suicide are depression and alcohol use disorders. Those two have been shown to be causally impacting on suicide, and I think everybody would know or would assume that deaths of despair is a correct term. The next category which was impacted by those would be liver cirrhosis. Liver cirrhosis has been rising quite dramatically, and that is in a country like the U.S., but also in Canada, by the way, 60, 70, almost 80% related to alcohol use and alcohol use disorders. The final category, overdose deaths, and while there can be a lot of different overdoses, the most important in the U.S. would be opioid overdoses, both from prescription opioids and from illicit opioids, and they made up several 10,000s in the last years, and they have been steadily increasing for at least 10 years.
I'm kind of intrigued by diseases like cirrhosis of the liver, because that seems to me like something that, as our medical proficiency increases, but also as awareness increases around diseases caused by alcoholism, that we should be seeing falling. And that sounds like a staggering number to me.
There are two developments going on there, and it is a staggering number. But first of all, we have to realize that for a lot of our people, if you look into surveys, alcohol is mainly a beneficial drug. People do not want to realize that actually alcohol is one of the top risk factors for premature death in the developed world. What we see here is that a lot of the alcohol control mechanisms in North America have been eroding. Alcohol has become more and more available. The shops per square meter have been increasing. The affordability of alcohol has been getting higher and higher. Affordability is not only the price, it's how much you have to work for one unit of alcohol, and that has been way, way higher in the 1950s, 60s, and has been decreasing almost constantly in all of North America. And other kind of control mechanisms do not exist in North America, except for some provinces in Canada. For example, the U.S. has no minimum price.
Right. We have minimum pricing in Canada, though.
We have minimum pricing in Canada. It's under attack, as you know.
It's the return of Buck a Beer in Ontario. As of today, you now have three choices for $1 beer at the LCBO and the beer stores. One of those choices comes
Beer a Buck is certain would be a decline of our minimum price in Ontario for a unit of alcohol by more than 20%. But Canada has been one of the few countries with minimum pricing and has always been cited in the European Parliament as the example where we should go and what we should do in European countries. And actually now Scotland, Ireland, and a number of other countries have been introducing minimum prices according to the model of Canada.
Up next.
I believe that we are slowly taking steps towards at least realizing what's going on and trying to prevent further problems.
You can save like never before with the Scotiabank Momentum Plus Savings Account. And now, for a limited time, you can earn up to 3.2% interest until March 10th. You can find all the terms and conditions at scotiabank.com/MP. I feel like, and this is why we wanted to talk to you, because I feel like we talk a lot about these factors individually. We've done an episode on an opioid crisis. We definitely did an episode on buck a beer and whether or not that was a good thing. But we've never made the connection between that and despair. And I wonder if that's being articulated anywhere.
I think it is much more difficult for governments to tackle inequality than to tackle minimum prices. I know that a lot of governments shed away from doing anything about alcohol because they fear it will hamper their chances to be reelected, but it is still a possibility, and governments see that as possibility. But to reduce inequality is much harder and is a real gargantuan task, because inequality has all but increasing in all countries, almost all countries which are developed over the last 20, 30 years, in fact, also since the Second World War. And it has been increasing in the U.S. to a degree that they have one of the highest inequality of high-income countries. And that is also part of why we see the current crisis, because even within those rural areas, it is very clear that the depths of despair are concentrated in the lower socioeconomic, in the people with lower socioeconomic status. And that means that it's also not only about having a tough situation, but being in a situation there where you see that other parts of the country, that other groups within the Americas are doing actually much better, are progressing, are fulfilling their goals, have hope, are determining the future, whereas they seem to be completely left over, part of an old style which is no longer valid in the area of globalization, and that has led to some of that despair.
You know what? It kind of sounds like you're describing the people that the New York Times and other publications describe as the economically anxious people who elected Trump.
The correlation between electing Trump, the percentage of people electing Trump, and the opioid overdose prescription rate and the opioid overdose prescription death is a moderately high positive correlation. So it is right. What you're saying is something which can be empirically shown. Yes, there's been an article in JAMA, one of the most important magazines, and they found that correlation.
How different is the situation Canada is in right now from the one America finds itself in? We're not actually falling yet in life expectancy.
Exactly. Basically, you can call it a glass half full if you want to defend the status quo, or a glass half empty.
Are we seeing some of these signs? Are we seeing the widening gap? What does it look like up here?
Very clearly, we do see some of those signs. The most recent report on public health for Canada, TAM has been pointing out that between 2011 and 2017, the alcohol attributable death rate for women increased by 26%.
Wow.
And that is in a situation where other death rates were decreasing, like for all cardiovascular, for cancer. The alcohol attributable death rate for men also increased by a lower percentage. Those are exactly the same signs we had seen in the U.S. And CHI-HI had reported in their last report that alcoholic liver cirrhosis, these are all liver cirrhosis which have been labeled as alcoholic on the death certificate. That's a vast underestimate, because a lot of people don't want on the death certificate of their family member a term like alcoholic, which is still quite stigmatizing. Those deaths, and if you assume that the stigma has been relatively constant, they have been increasing, and they have been increasing quite a lot. We have a number of other indicators, like overdose deaths, the opioid crisis of Canada. You've done your own show on that. That means it must have had a certain significance overall. And we do have now 4,000 opioid overdose deaths, and had way less than 2,000 only a few years ago. So those are the signs pointing in that wrong direction. What we do not have is the income inequality has been increasing, but not as dramatically as in the U.S., and we do not have increasing suicide rates. And that is something which has been increasing over a very short period for 49 out of 50 states in the U.S., with an average of 25% over a period of 5 years. The difference there is that our people, Canadians, still do not feel desperate. They believe, and if you look into surveys, and that this is sketchy, I admit that, if you look into surveys, most people still believe that their kids have a better life than themselves. Most of the U.S. people do no longer believe that.
How worried are you when you look at this data and you put it together about the future of life expectancy in Canada?
If I look at the data on both sides, I believe that we are slowly taking steps towards at least realizing what's going on and trying to prevent further problems. I'm saying that because suddenly it's no longer taboo to look into what our health system has done in prescribing way too many opioids. A lot of those people who die later on street opioids or on fentanyl have been made addictive by our healthcare system, and there's no real reason why Canada would need the second largest prescription rate of opioids in the world. We have 195 countries, but we have the second place, and we prescribe opioids for anything. I was at the dentist last week. I refused to take opioids with me, but I would have had a nice prescription of opioids, no problem. And those kinds of things are ubiquitous. And we are currently on the right track to come up with guidelines to have way less of those prescriptions, realize that the evidence is simply not there to have done all of those prescriptions in the first place. We cannot reduce opioid overdose deaths very quickly soon, but we can do that, and we're doing steps in the right direction. Also, alcohol control policy is being discussed. That doesn't mean that everything's going the right direction, but if you look into the 2018 report on public health, on substance use, it is being discussed. If you look into our parliaments, it's being discussed. The toughest will be the inequality, and that a lot of that will depend on the voting behavior. We should be honest about what we want and let the politicians know that we do care about those things, and we do care about those connections and associations, and that it is in our own interest to create less inequalities.
Dr. Jürgen Rem of the Center for Addiction and Mental Health and also the University of Toronto. That was the Big Story podcast brought to you by Scotiabank. You can earn up to 3.2% interest until March 10th with the Scotiabank Momentum Plus Savings Account. Conditions apply. For more from us, thebigstorypodcast.ca is your destination, that or frequencypodcastnetwork.com. Everything you need is there, our other shows, our other episodes, ways to get in touch with us. That include our social media accounts at Big Story Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. And of course, subscribe, rate, review, wherever you get podcasts, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, the list goes on. Thank you for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.